Two handouts. These are two different handouts. Don't get nervous. First of all, there's 10 o'clock deadline for sure, but one is really just for background. So at the risk of offending Alex, which is the last thing I would ever want to do, so I just wanted to admit something. When the topic of humility in medicine was suggested to me, I didn't get very excited about it. In fact, I was almost going to back out on it or try to change the suggestion, but held off for two reasons. One, the alternative that Alex offered me, which was to sort of describe the experience of raising Gavriel Apfel, while it has a certain appeal in certain respects, I figured some things are best kept in the family, if you know what I mean. Well, I could start. You know, it was a Yom Kippur day. My wife went into labor. I'll never forget it. Came back from Mincha just to check on things. You remember this? You probably don't remember. Yeah. And so I go running. I come excitedly home, and my wife says, okay, she thinks this is it. And we went to the hospital, you know, kehalacha, right? All things worked out. We anticipated maybe Yom Kippur would trigger something. We ended up, the labor and delivery was on the 13th floor, and I wasn't as well versed as I should have been, I think, in Hilchos Shabbos under these kind of conditions, which, you know, clearly everybody knows. If a woman's in labor, you know, that's very high level pikuach nefesh, and it's a davar pashut that you don't need to ask, you know, the woman questions to get heterin, to do things to facilitate her getting safely to her situation. So in other words, I didn't need to ask my wife anything about using an elevator. You know, I was going to go up with her in the elevator. But because I was ignorant back then, and this is a plug for everybody, maximally educate yourselves on the halachas, particularly of Shabbos, if you're going into medicine, it's really, really important. But I asked her, and I thought it was a perfunctory sort of almost rhetorical question. So Naomi, you want me to come up in the elevator, don't you? No, right? No. So you can imagine mommy doing that, right? Very easily. So I ran up the steps, you know, 13 steps, in, you know, anticipating Gav. You know, that's something to run up for. And I was wearing a coat. And then by the time I got up there, they ignored my wife, and they came to resuscitate me because I was, like, practically on the floor. But it was all worth it because when Gav was born, you know, all the other babies in the nursery were, like, kind of crying and doing the thing. But he was like... I said, boy, no, we have a very special child here. All right, but I can go on, but I don't know if we have enough time. So I'll switch over to the topic. Now, Alex's topic was tremendous. Because I know that it was coming. Is it okay if I mention it was your topic? Okay. I think the first time you mentioned it to me was a couple of years ago. I remember the first time I was struck, in all seriousness, by the conviction that it was coming from. There was something that triggered your desire to have that topic spoken about. Now, admittedly, I thought it was a little fluffy, you know. But fluffy topics sometimes are extremely important and should not be dismissed or ignored. Still, as I was trying to make it more than just, you know, some type of trite, you know, discussion of the obvious, because it's obvious that we should be not, you know, ignoring this midah of humility. It's such an important midah throughout our lives, and particularly in medicine, and looking for an angle. What's the unique angle for medicine? What's a way of making this somewhat interesting and compelling, keep people up at 9 o'clock at night? Like, what could it be? And then it struck me that it could be a very, very useful topic to finish up something that I started a number of years ago here at Einstein that I feel like I never completed. A number of people asked me a question at the end of one of the shiurim that I gave then that I really felt that I did not have an adequate answer. But somehow I think the topic of humility in medicine, whatever on earth that really means, which hopefully we'll try to address, can answer that up. So that's why there are two handouts. One of them is really just background, and I'm going to just fly through it. That's the one with the picture of Rav Schechter on the cover. And this topic, really, I spoke about it 2 years ago. That anyone who was here 2 years ago during the summer might recall. I see a couple of faces I remember from then. But I want to go back to the history of this topic. The reason this topic is so near and dear to me is because about 10 years ago or 8 years ago, I don't remember what it was already now, so much travel back and forth from Israel to America gets to you after a while. But I remember that year I was giving like 2 or 3 years series on medical halacha. And you remember that, right? And the group back then, as I'm sure the group now, were unbelievable. I was floored because when I was in medical school, did not have this type of chevra around me. It was just unbelievable, the enthusiasm and interest and how they wanted to get, first of all, halacha l'maisa, to get down Hilchos Shabbos and all the halachas that relate to being a doctor really, really well. And that wasn't enough. They wanted all the eon in the background. They had a special shiur. We had 2, sometimes 3 times a week we would meet. It was like unbelievable. These guys were just like, and women as well, extremely enthusiastic, and it was great. It was the, you know, next to Shraga, like the one of the most fantastic teaching and learning experiences that I've ever had. And then one day I come in, and it's like the affect changed so dramatically. It was frightening to me a little. Everybody was like down and moping around. It was such a change. And I said, all right, you know, like they obviously were so dramatizing their upsetness that they wanted to talk about it. So I said, Newt, what's going on? Like, let's hear it. What's going on? So apparently what had happened was a series of events that led them into this near depression. And I'm not exaggerating. And what was going on was it started with a Q&A, I think, that Rav Schechter had given. That's why he's right there up in the front. Where someone had asked him a question somewhat to the following effect, and it's on YU Torah, so I have no hesitation to share this. Where basically, you know, he felt that he was, able and ready to go in learning and able and ready to go in his sciences, but he felt that because of Pikuach Nefesh, he had an achrayus to go into medicine as opposed to continuing in learning. He posed that as a question to Rav Schechter, what do you think? So that's he didn't realize it, but I did, because I dealt with this like 20 years before then. Maybe it was last, whenever it was. That now would be that. But I had asked the same kind of question to Rav Schechter once and got an incredibly powerful response from him, meaning like this is one of his pet peeves. He doesn't want people to think that if you're really smart and able that you need to go into medicine. You should consider very seriously going into chinuch and learning and klikodesh and something along those lines. And I think over the span of time, he's kind of modified the view a little bit, because back in the day when he felt not enough people were seriously going into chinuch and things like that, he felt much stronger and he thought that there was a deficiency out there in imparting this message. So he expressed all that, and you see some of it, they actually, when a Torah web came out, which voiced the same idea. And also what was behind it was Rav Schechter was also very bothered, as were other Rosh Yeshiva, that they felt there was a general sort of lackadaisical attitude towards halacha amongst doctors. That doctors felt that once they were a doctor, you know, it's kind of like a license, carte blanche, to ignore halachos. And, you know, obviously, you know, that's a very major problem if that were true. So it came out sort of with a kind of negative feeling, but they kind of put that into perspective. What really was the killer was the week before my discussion with them about this, what really threw them all out of whack was there was great anticipation because Avraham Sofer Avraham, I'm sure you've all heard of him, Nishmas Avraham, right? The man, like he's the man, right? Doctor, he will not allow himself to be called rabbi, but he's one of the biggest Talmidei Chachamim around. He knows, you know, Shas, Shulchan Aruch, all Arba Chalakim, backwards, forwards. Really amazing person, Bayit Vegan, actually, where he lived. And the anticipation of his visit was unbelievable. Everybody's all excited. They're fighting over who's going to pick him up from the airport. I remember that. We could do a lottery, whatever, you know, and great, great excitement. He comes in, and he gives the same type of shmooze as Rav Schechter. It was unbelievably deflating to them. Because, like, he spent most of the time saying, you know, because he had the same concerns about what he felt was an attitude out there of the growing dismissal of the significance of halacha by doctors. And he wanted to, like, you know, shake everybody up. So he started saying, you know, you shouldn't really necessarily go into this. Here are guys that just spent all their pre-med time and all that. They made it, did the MCATs and all that stuff. They're in medical school already. Look, you know, it's a done deal. This is the wrong audience to have this discussion with. But nevertheless, it was on his mind and he was bothered by it, and he gave that same kind of really deflating discussion. So this really got them, and they started looking around. They look at Rabbi Blech, who's on the bottom, and they hear the same sentiments from him, and somebody was assigned to check in with him. Is it really true? You know, and he confirmed. Is this some kind of Chabad idea? Right? Yeah? So, what are you alluding to?
Maybe he would have spoken about a lot of other things.
Right. No, I'm not criticizing. He's one of my idols. I'm definitely not criticizing him at all. I'm just saying I felt so bad. And if I had a chance to speak to him beforehand, I would have tried to head that off. And the timing was incredible. Then they started looking into this topic. They were ma'ayin. This became the topic of the time. And they looked at Rav Moshe has incredible statements. Part of Rav Schechter's whole feelings and sentiments on this issue, after speaking to him, really arise from Rav Moshe's two pieces. One on Kohanim becoming doctors. The other one on autopsies. Where Rav Moshe also digs in there, you know, about, you know, if, a statement like this. If there were no doctors in the world, don't tell me pikuach nefesh is the reason you should become a doctor if you're a kohen. Just forget it, you know. And other statements as to, you know, really a person should be learning, right? A person should be learning. That's the basically if you go into medicine, your life. This was really the final catchphrase they all used. My life is a b'di'evet. I've chosen a b'di'evet, right? So I hope I haven't demoralized anyone in this room, but I'm trying to create that atmosphere purposefully because. Because immediately, you know, it called for action, right? And I was very, very, you know, motivated to change what was a total misunderstanding of what these Gedolim were saying. They had and if you had that impression, good, because I was trying to create that effect. But in reality, it's wrong. That's not what they don't mean that any of you are living, or me, a d'eved life. We're not living the d'eved life. And to me, this was always something that was quite intuitive. Like, I never thought I was. But this group, they were so inclined to look for Makaros, they needed to see it. Is it really true, or is it just apologetics, that choosing medicine is a great option as a lechatchila? So I told them first to look on the page 2, on the top there, is Rosh Shlomo Zalman, quoted in Lev Avram, before he wrote Nishmas Avram, right? Obviously, most of you know that Rav Avram Sofer Avram wrote Lev Avram. And he asked Rosh Shlomo Zalman about studying medicine on Shabbos. And Rosh Shlomo Zalman came out the chumra on this, but you know we can't talk about it now. But don't anyone who studies medicine on Shabbos, this is a very machmir shita. It's not that's not ikar hadin. This is the chumra if you're going to hold a certain shita. Nevertheless, what was important was that he again Rosh Shlomo Zalman seemed at first to be saying exactly what all the others were saying. She ikar achiv shel Yehudi hu lilmod Torah. So he says, of course, he said, the ikar responsibility of a Jew is to learn Torah, and any heterim not to, you should realize, it's just for people that are not, and this is a very important word, mesugal. What does the word mesugal mean? Somebody? What? Better. That's better, right? I'm segula. Let's go with destined for the moment. You'll pick it up. It's going to be a very, very important word. It's going to be a word that's going to repeat itself in many contexts. And I think it's where Shlomo Zalman here, seemingly having that same negative attitude, is going to turn things around. So he says, anyone who's eno mesugal lekayem zel shetarasu tiyem nasav alav lilmod miksora, so you have to learn something, rak az im hu mesugal lilmod refuah, right? Yilmod refua b'matara l'tapel l'azur l'chole Yisrael. Ach tzarich l'hachmish l'lilmod b'Shabbos. Right? So that he thought was a very reasonable chomer because he wanted to impress everybody with the idea that there's no sakanas nefashos that allows you to be mechal Shabbos in any sense for medicine if you're just studying. Once you're a doctor, Rav Shlomo Zalman has a different psak. he says that once you're a doctor, you absolutely are chayiv to learn as much medicine as you possibly can, even if it's on Shabbos, because you're being metapel b'chol. But again, this is a chumrah, does not necessarily represent the ikar din in terms of studying Sifrei Chochma. We paskin, the Shulchan Aruch paskin, Sifrei Chochma are mutter to learn on Shabbos. So minimally you could do that. But anyway, getting back to the focus, once Rav Shlomo Zalman throws in the word mesugal, and he says it two ways. First he says, you're not mesugal to sit and learn all day, and you are mesugal to practice medicine. What's he getting at? So he's getting at something that I always took for granted, and I was shocked that these guys that I was talking to needed me to kind of educate them on, but I did it. So let's just run through this very quickly so we can get to humility, and you'll see why there's going to be something that we need to fill in at the end of this. So I told them on page 3, take a look, the sugyas are so obvious. It's clear from Koheles, from the Gemara and Brachos, that Hashem instills within us, right? Hashem instills within us a netiya, right? Every human being has a netiya within them that they are meant to follow. Amar Rav Zutra Bar Tuvia, I'm in the Gemara and Brachos. Amar Rav, Mai Dechsiv Esakol Asa Yafe Be'ito, right? That's quoting from Koheles. What does that mean? Melamed Shekol Echad Echad Yafe Lo Kadosh Baruch Hu Umnaso Befanav, right? So over here, if you look at the Netziv and the Marsha and the Rashi on describing what exactly Pshat in this Gemara is, he says, Hashem has arranged within all of us a certain Netziv towards a vocation that we should think it's the best, whatever that may be. Now, right away, that's an implication. The implication is that if my netiya is to be a doctor, you know, that's a God-given netiya. How could that be a b'dieved? And how far does this go? If you look at the next page quickly, so it goes to an amazing degree. This is one of my favorite Gemaras. I'm surprised that it's not quoted in Nishmas Avram. It should be. Tanu Rabbanan, Shlosha Kadosh Baruch Hu Bocha Aleihem. Hashem cries over three people. Who are the three? We're going to mention just the two. And he cries every day. Al she'efshar lasok b'torah ve'eino osek. So this is clearly one. A person who is able to learn. He's mesugal. Right? He's destined. I'm going to keep using that. I like that. He's destined to be a learner. He's destined to be a mechanic. He's destined to be someone involved in Talmud Torah all the time. And he doesn't do it. So Hashem's crying over that person. But who else? Here's the amazing one. The al she'efshar lasok b'torah ve'osek. That's an incredible line of Gemara. And someone who's not mesugal to sit and learn, and does it anyway. Hashem's crying over that person. That's not what you hear in Shraga, for example. You don't. That's not the party line, is it? But it's before us right here in the Gemara. What does it mean? So, it's obvious what it means. It means it's where that netiya concept goes. There are all sorts of netiyas implanted in mankind, because mankind is meant to be a varied group with different emphases. Everybody l'shem shemayim, right? Everybody should be operating towards maximizing their avodas Hashem, but in very different ways. As a lechatchila, l'chuli alma, everyone's a lechatchila. And what really, really I enjoyed the most in trying to put everybody at ease who was feeling this way was to quote from Rav Shechter. And here I see this, I had heard myself from him, but Rabbi Simon, Rabbi Baruch Simon, put it into his sefer. So now I have it in print. It's even more enjoyable for me. He's talking about that. He quotes that Gemara that in Chagiga. And he says, again, you'll see on the lower right-hand corner, the word mesugal, right? Harei HaKadosh Baruch Hu bara b'nei Adam kochel shonim v'kishronot shonim. Right? Everybody has within them different powers, different abilities, different capabilities. V'kol echad yachal lios. And everybody can be very successful in whatever the netiya was that they were granted, whatever the special talents and abilities that they were given. And there's an achrayus for a person, if you don't want Hashem crying over you, there's an achrayus that you have to meet your netiya and to go with it, and not fight it. Even if it means you're not the one who's going to be sitting and learning all the time. If you're going to be doing something else, but that's your netiya, that's your destiny for you to maximize, of course, right? L'shem shamayim. then you have an achrayus. It's not just heter. It's an achrayus to go that way. And the one who really caps it off is Rav Shachter. He says over here, Shamati mi Rav Shachter, Sha'klav azehu sha'kadosh baruch hu bocha al anashim sha'oskim bedvarim shehem lo mesugalim. There it is again. Mesugal, mesugal, mesugal. Right? I'm not going to read the whole thing because we're running out of time. I want to get to humility. But at the end of the day, it was clear as day by Rav Shechter himself, the one who, started the ball rolling in terms of their depression, right? He himself is the one who very, very clearly states that at the end of the day, if you don't want Hashem to cry, then you should go with what your Netiyah tells you to do, and presumably that is where we've all been drawn to medicine as our Netiyah. And therefore, we have an achrayus to go with it, right? And maximize it. Maximize it, obviously, in the right way. So, when I got to this point in trying to cheer everyone up and get them out of it, so I saw some rays of hope. You know, there was like less frowning and moping and I'm a diavid, people will stop crying there. But it wasn't quite returning to the enthusiasm that I was looking for. I still wanted them to be very enthusiastic, right? My God. So, they asked me, well, how do we know? Maybe we're fooling ourselves. Not a bad question. Now, maybe it's all like a big, you know, I don't really, you know, I want to get out of learning and I want to, whatever, I want to somehow make myself believe that I'm mesugal for this. So I said, well, you know, the Achronim talk at length, and I only gave three examples here, but there's many discussions on this idea, because it's a very accepted idea. It's not apologetics by any means. It's an absolute emistic, it's a valid idea that is well known and accepted as a lechatchila. But when on page 5, you'll find these methodologies for making sure you did the right thing. What does the Netziv say? The Netziv says, quoting from Koheles, right? It says, very interesting line in Koheles. It says, Smach b'chor b'yildusecha, v'yitivcha libcha b'yimei b'churasecha, v'halach b'darkei libcha, libecha, u'bimara einecha. Right? Exact opposite of a lo sasur chari levavchem mecher einechem. Here, Koheles is telling you, do just that, right? Torah says, v'lo sasur chari levavchem mecher einechem. He's telling you, make sure you go after your heart and after your eyes. So the Netziv is bothered by that a little. He says, what's going on here? Shlomo's going against the Torah. How could it be? So the Netziv says, no, he's telling you this yisod that we've been talking about. And he first, in the upper paragraph where it's underlined, he mentions over there because that you should realize that not everybody's meant to do the same thing. Everybody has their different netiyah. And he then gets into a discussion. So how am I supposed to know? So he says, in the lower paragraph, Im ba adam lishol ezehu derech yashara, what should be the derech hayashar for me? How do I know that I'm doing the right thing? So for this, Kohelet says, halach bedarkei libecha, which means, basically, intuitively, we know, right? So approach number one as to whether you found what you're mesugal for, if you found your netiyah, is just an intuitive sense, this is what I was meant to do. Now, there are many people that works for. Right? Not everybody, but a lot of people. Rav Shmulevitz modifies it a little, and he gives a little different idea. He says, the way you know is you look for what seems yashar to you. Hashem, another thing Hashem has instilled in us, and this C.S. Lewis has made very popular in the world, the idea that Hashem has instilled in us a sense of what is yashar, what is a correct, what is right, what is ethically, morally correct and right. We all have that intuitive sense. So use that to determine whether your choice was correct. That's what Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says. And then Rav Nevensol, he says, look for what you can best elevate yourself in Ruchnius. Right? If it's going to be, you know, going into Chinuch, you should do that. And if your Netiyah is that way and you're going to be great at it, then you have an intuitive sense that that's the way to go and you're going to elevate your Ruchnius and other people's Ruchnius, go for it. But if it's not, if it's going to be something else, then you're chayav to go that. And I was purposely looking for a spectrum of gedolim that say this from all parts of the spectrum, and it seems to be a very unified response. So we move on to page 5, and then finally we ended this whole discussion where I thought I was beginning to retrieve everybody into a state of bliss of going into medicine again by showing them that in the Sefer Hasidim, they uniquely apply this to becoming a doctor. and they go as far as to say the following, that if you're meant to be a doctor and you don't do it, you're a shofech damim. It's an amazing thing. That's what Rav Avram Price, who's one of the Peirush on the Sefer Hasidim, he says, it's mamish pshat over here. That's the pshat in this piece from the Sefer Hasidim. He says there was a father, and in the old days when it was like an apprentice kind of relationship in learning to become a doctor, you didn't have to go to medical school, you didn't have to do all the rest of this stuff, right? You just had your father and he taught you how to be a doctor. And you know, what, 90% mortality, whatever it was, you know. But still, that was the way it was done, right? So back in that day, there was a father, he said to his son, the Sefer Hasidim reports, okay, come learn medicine, I want you to be a doctor. So the son's thinking and he's saying, wow, well, if I become a doctor, then I'm stuck. Because if there's going to be a poor person far away, I'm going to have to go see him, otherwise I'm letting him die and I'm chayav misa. And then if I go to see him, I might kill him, and then I'll be chayav misa. This is like a no-win-win. I'm not doing it. So that's when the Sefer Hasidim says, Kevan sheyecholet lecha lilmod, velasos ve'eno oseh velomed, ki'ilu ata tamisotam. You're a killer. If you're supposed to be a doctor, you're right, it's an amazing, amazing extent to where this goes. And the other sections on here are from other Gedolim, Rav Yaakov Breish, Tachalchus Yaakov, Rav Moshe Mordechai, all telling that if you're mesugal to do this, becoming a doctor is a tremendous, fantastic lechatchila. So, wow, shouldn't everybody really be excited about becoming, everyone here excited about becoming a doctor now? Yeah? Sally? You? No? Not yet. Okay. So, so they weren't either. So I still wasn't there. I said, okay, I got to pull out the big guns. I said, I want everyone back to the way I had it. I was very selfish. I had the greatest group, next again, right? And I lost them, and now I got to get back. So I said, all right, I'm going to quote you something from an article I had just read around that time. It's from the British Journal of Medicine. Very interesting article about describing the difference between being a mentor and a role model. And this is something that I've really taken with me into chinuch, because it's such an important yisod. I really would love to write the author of this article. He made the following point. They said, you know, there's two ways to teach people. Mentoring, which means sort of scheduled, you know, like you schedule a schmooze with somebody, or you sit down and you have like, hey Rebbe, I have a bunch of questions, can we sit down and meet, and I'd like to discuss them. That's called mentoring, and then you try to help them, and you give them answers, and you discuss. So that's one avenue, and he was saying that as doctors, right, he's not talking about Rebbeim, he's talking about physicians, and he's saying as a physician, you have great opportunity to be a mentor to the younger people. Fantastic. But he says that's not nearly as important as an opportunity that you have as a doctor in medicine that you get nowhere else to the degree. You have this opportunity in a lot of places in life, but to the degree that you have it in medicine, it's unparalleled, and that's to be a role model. What does it mean to be a role model? How's that different than mentoring? A role model is always serendipitously happening. He quotes John Lennon, a very good quote from John Lennon. To paraphrase John Lennon, being a role model is what happens when you're busy doing other things. What does it mean to be a role model? A role model is the most effective way, and perhaps the only way, to impart midos. You're never going to impart any mida to a person through mentoring, through some intellectual exercise, or from discussion and reading and textual analysis. None of that imparts midos. The only way is to really role model. Because role model is the only genuine expression of things that really exists. Just, I'll give you one example. I remember when I was in college, and it's going to seem like a trivial example, but it's so much, and it's so much to the point. This was a turning point in my life. I was in college. I had not gone to Eretz Yisrael. I went right from high school to college, and I was like put into this dorm room with 8 guys that all came back from like Shana Bet, Shana Gimel, and I was the Kiruv project of the dorm room. Everyone was Makar of me, right? There was the Gush guy being Makar of me his way, the KBY guy, the Shalavim guy, right? There was no Shraga, I'm sure he would have tried it too, but everybody was like being Makar of me. So, you know, they got me interested in learning because it was very interesting and I was very intellectually stimulated, but no one was like driving me to Eretz Yisrael or getting me to drop out of college and do something dramatic. And then one night, we were playing basketball, and, you know, it was in the middle of not such a great neighborhood. It was about 1 a.m. in the morning, and I'm coming home with my good friend, and who was, like, you know, quite an amazing person. And walking in the street, and we see this little old lady, you know, walking there at like 1 in the morning in Morningside Heights. Like, it was like not a pretty picture. And I remember I was walking by, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, I can't believe this lady's out here walking in the middle of the night. So I thought that, and I kept going. My friend, 2 years in childhood, not bad, right? He walks by, and he stops. He also, first, we passed her together. He stops, turns around, goes over to her, and says, can we walk you home? And then we did it. And I remember the impact of that serendipitous event. It was like nothing, right? But it showed me, I said, wow, that's how I want to be. I want to be like this guy. And the expression was incredibly powerful because it was so genuine. It was so really what he was about. And this article makes that same point. This article says, you have an opportunity in medicine all the time to be doing things like this. So, wow, this must be an amazing field. If we could role model tremendous midos on a continuous basis, what an amazing lechatchila field to go into. So was that enough for them? It was interesting to them, but didn't quite get them. What got them was the next piece, this Gemara from Tanis, which is a famous Gemara, you might have heard of it, but it's really incredible. If you really pay attention to what this Gemara is saying, it really knocks your socks off. Abba umna hava asi le shama kol yoma mimisifta derakia. Abba umna, Abba the doctor, right? We're not going to talk about bloodletting, right? Even though there are some conditions where they still do it, right? Leeches and stuff like that. But polycythemia, right? Abba the umna used to get a hello from God and Shemayim every day. Not bad. Abaye, the great Amora, mimale shabsa lemale shabsa. You got it once a week, right? Rabba, poor Rabba, he only got it from Yom Kippur to Yom Kippur, once a year. Now, Rabba could handle it, but apparently Abaye was not very happy about this. Abaye said, whoa, what am I doing wrong? Why does Abba Umna get so much more? Why is Shamayim so much happier with him? He got very upset. Al da Abba Umna, because of what was going on with this Abba Umna. Amrule, the Rabbanim said to him, take it easy. You just, it's not your fault. Because of what he does versus what you do, what does he do? He's a Rosh Yeshiva, right? You're just a Rosh Yeshiva. He's a doctor. Now, remember this whenever you, this is a great one, right? He's a doctor. He can do it. You just don't get the opportunity to do what he can do. That's why he gets such favor in the eyes of Shemayim. Unbelievable. So Abaye was okay. He says, you're right. You know, there's nothing I can do about that. It's an incredible, wow, what's the Gemara saying? You know, we're that good? So now they really started to get excited. There was excitement in the room. Hey, wow, what is this Gemara? Where is this? All right, let's look it up, double check. Where do you make it up? You know, the whole thing. So I said, no, read it. I'm not making up the Gemara. Look at it. Look at the Marsha, what he says about it. Then the Gemara goes through a description. We're all waiting to hear. What's so great about this? Abba Umna, what on earth is he doing to deserve this? What could we be doing? And it goes through a whole series of things. It says, number one, he was very tzanua in his office. He separated the men and the women. And then whenever he did his bloodletting procedure, he was making, on a woman, he made sure to do it in a very tzanua way. He covered her up. And then he had this special room for payment. But it was kept in a very special private way that no one knew what anyone else was doing. It reminds me of Tractor Ronim. Remember? There was this, when we went out to Israel, there was this fun little thing that we like to do called Tractoronim. It was really, I think they liked to do it. I didn't really like to do it so much. But what was very special about it is when we used to have to pay for it, the guy would take everybody privately into a room. It reminded me, this Gemara reminded me of that, where no one knew what anyone else was paying. That his thing was to charge the Americans triple what the Israelis were paying. But this guy over here, right, that wasn't what Abba Umna was about. He was doing it because he wanted to make sure that anyone who couldn't pay wasn't embarrassed. And then it says a few more things that he did. He also used to take money out to give to someone he noted who he was treating was poor. He would give them money. And then he goes through this whole test where they stole something from him. and he was down them l'chav schos, a whole discussion. At the end of the day, there's something very mysterious about this Gemara. The Gemara says that Abba Umna is unique in the fact that he was a doctor, and that's what made him potentially superior to Abaye, the Rosh Hashiva. And yet, when they describe all the great things he did, not one thing related to being a doctor. That's the Shiloh. They said, what on earth are you talking about? He said, all the things he did, anyone could do that. And, you know, they started to be grumpy again. And I said, you know, good question. Hold the thought. And I never got back to them. So now I'm going to get back to them. So any of you out there from 10 years ago, Alex's question about humility in medicine is going to be the answer to I think, explaining Abba Umna, what was really great about him. Why was he so great? Ad kedei kach, he's better than Abaye, gets visited by an hello from Shamayim every day, right? And why being a doctor is really a great thing, right? Why? It has to do with humility and the opportunities of humility in medicine. Now, sounds strange, sounds like it has nothing to do with it. It almost sounds like I was using this as an excuse to review that other topic. Maybe that was subconsciously what I was doing. But the truth of the matter is, I think you'll see what I'm talking about, that it actually will fit in at the end. So let's talk about this topic, again, at the risk of getting fluffy, with a topic called humility in medicine. What exactly is humility? In order to really understand this and address this. So I looked up in 4 or 5 different places exactly the definition of the word humility. And I got the following. I'll tell you the sources. Google says, humility means a modest or low view of one's own importance. And gives some synonyms, right? Meekness, unassertiveness, humbleness. The Oxford Dictionary says, similarly, which is probably where Google got it, right? A modest or low view of one's own importance. Merriam-Webster says, the quality of not thinking better that you are better than other people. Cambridge says, the quality of not being proud because you are aware of your bad qualities, right? Everyone agreed that all these are good definitions of humility? Is that really an accurate definition of humility? Well, we could debate it. Let's say it is. When it comes to medicine, it's a horrible definition, and I'll explain to you why. I remember when I found this out. In other words, the definition being that humility means that the virtue of humility is to really focus on the low level of yourself, to focus on your chesronot, right? That's what humility is. So I remember that when I was the first week of my fellowship, I was doing rounds in the ICU with somebody that was like my idol in medicine, chairman of my department, very chashuv, a pediatric cardiologist. I really admired him tremendously. I thought he was like unbelievable. We're going on rounds, and he's going through each patient, and we're stopping by a patient, and for some reason, it irritated the surgeon who was involved in that patient. Surgeon was arguably the number one surgeon in the world, right? His name's Dr. Keel. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me talking about him in a base medrash. Dr. Q comes up, and you got to know this Dr. Q is quite an amazing person. He comes up there, and he starts yelling at the chairman. I just couldn't believe it. It's like yelling at your father. You know, like it's a son yelling at the father in front of the siblings. It's just a very uncomfortable thing, you know. You know, Dr. Q, you're a great surgeon, but what on earth are you doing? And then after he was done yelling at the chairman, which I'd never seen anything like it, I go to the chairman, you know, I said, wow, that is the most arrogant person I've ever met in my life. So he says to me, yes, and thank God he is. I'm thinking, what? You know, arrogance is a good thing? Like, what are you talking about? Boy, I'm such a rookie, I don't know what he's talking about. I found out within a week. Within a week was my first on-call. So I'm on-call, you know, as a cardiology fellow. And boy, is that scary, I got to tell you. No one gets scared now, but, you know, you think you made it through your 3 years of residency enough, you know, as an intern you're scared. As a resident, you're not. And as a third-year resident, you're certainly not. Now you start your fellowship all over again, and you're thrust into the ICU, and I'll never forget, we go on rounds. I went on rounds with the attending, and it was like, you know, the most sweaty experience for me in the world. This one's going to die tonight. This one might die tonight. That one, you know, maybe you'll get a few hours. And each one is critically ill, and oh my God, oh my God. This patient over here, don't worry about it. That's just an ASD repair. Everything will be fine. So, well, if they were looking to scare me, they were very successful. I was scared out of my mind. I was not planning on going to sleep at all, no matter how stable everybody seemed to be. And I was rounding over and over again, I remember. Rounding, all right, I finish rounding, I'll start again. And I rounded every time. I was sure I was going to miss something. Something's going to happen to somebody. Finally, out of sheer exhaustion, the nurses are laughing, and they're watching me do this. And I just, like, said, I'm going to lie down for a few seconds, you know. But wake me up if anybody beeps, anything, right? Their SAT's not, you don't tell me that their SAT is not correlating. Assume that the SAT is down. Call me out there, right? So I go into the room, I'm down within a few minutes. They're knocking on the door and they're waking me up. Oh, my God, arrest! Who's arresting? The ASD that nothing was going to happen to them. Great. So I come running out there, and I'm, like, in a daze and in a panic. And I'm going, oh, my God, what's going on? What do I do? And I'm trying to, like, calm myself down and, like, figure out what's going on with this kid. This kid was supposed to be, like, a piece of cake. But he's you know, he's getting bradycardic. His blood pressure's dropping. He's about to go into a full cardiac arrest. When who walks by? The famous Dr. Oz. Everybody's heard of him? Anyone not hear of him? Right? So he was training at the same time. So now, he's not what I would call humble, right? By any means. But he's looking at me, and he's seeing me going crazy and sweating, and I'm thinking to myself, I know what I need to do now is really open this kid's chest. That's what I should have done. And, like, you know, subsequently, I would have definitely done that. But if my first time, I was meek. I was humble. I was very, very, very timid. There's no way I was opening up this kid's chest. So Mehmet says, why don't you open his chest? And he's looking at me be this wimpy person, and in his arrogance, comes over, pushes me out of the way, does the right thing, opens up the chest, takes out, there was a big clot that had formed in front of the heart that was compressing, tamponading him, and saved the kid's life. And then it hit me, so now I know what Dr. Gerson is talking about. What if I said his name? But it doesn't matter. that, you know, in certain fields and respects in medicine, it's very important, especially surgery, any intervention, you need to be very confident, almost arrogant. Right, Dr. Q, who's the person I was talking about before, is the world's, he was in his prime, the top surgeon in the world. And part of it was because he did things and he had confidence in himself. If he didn't, it would be a disaster. So the definitions that we have now, so humility being a plus in medicine, certainly does not apply to not recognizing your abilities and not being confident and not being positive about your kishronos, that you are able to do things, you have a certain intelligence, you have a certain ability, be proud of it. That's a positive. It isn't like that. So what does it mean? What does anivus really mean? What is it supposed to be? So if you have this handout, I don't know if you do, I decided that I really need to look at this, as much as I admire Dr. Q and Dr. Gerstini and all the other doctors that I've worked with, what does the Torah have to say about it? What does Chazal have to say about humility? How do they view it? Is it different? Are they going to give those definitions like, you know, Cambridge and Oxford and Google? So, absolutely not. In fact, they seem at first totally to approach the concept of humility exactly in the same fashion as the surgeons. Gemara says in the Dharam, Amar Rav Yochanan, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mashresh chinaso ela al gibor va'ashir v'chacham va'anav. The kulan mimoshe. So the Gemara says in the Dharam that if you want nevuah, if you want hashrash hashchina, if you want to get divine communication, very special position to be in, you're going to need to have certain qualities. What are those qualities? You got to be strong, like Gav, va'ashir, v'chacham, va'anav. All those are really important qualities. And there's a Gemara in Shabbos that adds one. And you got to be tall. Like Mitzala. So, I understand Anav, modest, because that seems to be a godly-like quality. And I understand even Chacham, you know, wise. What's with the rich and what's with the strong and the tall? What is that necessary for the Hashrah Shashrim? So there's a very, very fascinating machlokas rishonim and achronim over how to make sense of this. The Rambam sees it as, and it's very difficult, this Rambam, but Kedarko, he sees it as purely moral and intellectual qualities. The only way you're going to get the shchina is through perfection. What's Gibor? A Kovish is Yitzro, right? It's a moral quality. It's somebody who can have self-control. What does it mean, Asher? It means Asher Bebina Bedas, that you have, you're rich in wisdom. So comes along the Drosha Saran and even the Kesef Mishnah on that Rambam, and they attack him. What are you talking about? Didn't you read the Gemara? When the Gemara gives examples of those qualities, it gives physical examples. It shows that Moshe was a Gibor because he lifted heavy things. And he was an usher because he got a lot of money. And he was tall. Mamish. So what are you talking about, Rambam? So they give an alternative. They say no. Right? And this is a pshat I've heard many times from someone near and dear to me. He says, you know, don't minimize the qualities of being tall and making a good impression and dressing nicely and all sorts of positives, externals, that you would perhaps say are not so chashuv in terms of a spiritual nature. But those are important because they give you a sense of authority and people will listen to you. And that's an important quality for someone who's going to be a leader. So that's all these are great pshatim. Comes along the Torah Tmima, I think, with a great insight to help us really understand what humility is. And the Torah Tmima says, no, everyone's missing the point. All the Rishonim, I have a better pshat. And I have to like his pshat the best. And he says the following. He says, you could read it, it's over there on the bottom, but now I don't have time anymore to read anything. So I'm going to start to move. He says, no, all of these are talking about anivus. All of these are talking about humility. What's the point? If somebody is not proud and not strong and not tall in any sense, someone like that, and they're humble, what does that mean? That doesn't mean anything, right? They're humble because they got nothing, right? It's a famous quote from Winston Churchill, I think. Right? I think it was Winston Churchill who said this when... he was told one of the other world leaders was very humble. He says, sure, he's humble. He's got nothing to be not humble about, right? It's a great line, right? And that's exactly the point that Tartu was saying. But if a person, when do you see true anivos? When do you see the greatness of an anav? When he is strong and rich and tall and has all these great qualities. And despite that, right, the expression he uses, he says, va'al kol elahu anav. That's pshat in the Gemara. It's an amazing pshat. And it opens up something that's really even further insightful. He says, and not only is it because the setting allows us to see the truth, the legitimacy, the valid nature of his anivus, because it's real. He could be stepping on everybody and feel like Dr. Q, but he doesn't have to, because he knows that he could be anav. He says, the fact that this can go, a person like that can go in one of two directions, and he chooses to not be about Gaiva, but he chooses that one, that's an amazing, amazing midah and milah that's necessary to have a shrush of shechina. This exact same idea, very similarly, is really the Tiferes Yisrael's pshat in Tov Shebarofim Legehenna, right? That famous, oft joked about, quoted line. Tov Shebarofim Legehenna, what does it mean exactly? So the Tiferes Yisrael says, it is totally l'shevach for doctors. Tov Shebarofim Legehenna is the biggest praise a doctor can get. Why? Because he says, it doesn't say kosher shibarofim legehanim. It says tov. What's the point? Because the next line, when it talks about the butchers, it talks about a kosher by the butchers. It's a whole other pshat. But by the doctors, it says tov. Why? Because he says, a doctor is somebody who is on the precipice of going to Gehenna. A doctor's setup, because of the nature of what he does, is someone continuously at risk for going to Gehenna. And if he does the wrong thing, that's where he ends up. But if he doesn't, then how much greater is accomplishment? So why are we on the precipice of going to Gehenna? Why is it a setup for that? So he mentions two things that I always thought were obvious. Like, this is why I didn't want to do Alex's topic. Humility in medicine is important. Why is it important? Because of what he's about to say. So we're going to need to take it a little step further, but this is important anyway. Even the well-known pshat, the obvious, is going to be very important to repeat. And what is that pshat? The pshat is that a person who thinks that they're so smart and so good in medicine, that they don't have to be obsessive about reading and examining and evaluating the needs of their patient, right? That person is a tov shebarofim that will head to Gehenna. Or one who thinks he's so good, he doesn't need to get a second opinion or refer out, and thinks that he should handle everything, which is a very prevalent disease amongst doctors, which none of you should have, right? That person also is just setting himself up for Gehenna. So the Tiferes Yisrael says, the fact that doctors are so easily thrown into that, One, because everybody's adulating, they're constantly being praised, and there's so much opportunity for us to think very highly of ourselves, and there's so much pressure on us to not want to show any weaknesses and any humility of admitting that we maybe don't know everything and we maybe can't handle everything, that the gates of Gehenna, not the gates, but the pits of Gehenna are before us, right? And if we can overcome it and not do it, right? So says the Tiferes Yisrael. So then our accomplishment is so great and so fantastic. Now, what's important about this, and the reason I said it was like old and tried and true and not something I wanted to talk about, is it's right in the Shulchan Aruch, right? It all comes out of Torah Sa'adam and the Ramban, on the Ramban in the next page, right? It's very, very well known with this pshat. And this is what the Ramban says, and it's very common. But I don't want to belabor it, but go to page 4 on this handout. You'll see what I realized. There is a dimension to anivus that goes well beyond this obvious one, right? So the obvious, just to repeat, the obvious dimension of anivus is this idea that you shouldn't be so proud and not to call in help when you need it. You shouldn't think, you know, I'll just give you one example. I can unfortunately think of 1,000 examples of this phenomenon amongst doctors. But I remember the first exposure I had to this problem was I was in shul in my first year in medical school. And I was there with 2 good friends. And, of course, your first year in medical school. Who's in their first year in medical school? Anybody here? You guys know everything, right? So what happens? The guy comes over. I'll never forget this. He comes over to us, and he's got this rash. And he heard that we're in medical school. So obviously, we're the ones to ask about a rash. I could be in pediatrics 30 years, and I don't know one rash from another. Just to let you know. Rashes, no one knows rashes, right? You know, steroids, dry it, wet it, whatever, all that stuff. That's all they know. No, sorry, dermatologists, I really apologize. That it just happens to be my experience. Now, so this guy comes over to us, the 3 first month medical students. Hey, what do you think this rash is? So I'm like thinking to myself, thank God I didn't open my mouth. I'm saying, I don't know what it is, right? I have no idea, right? So, but one of my friends, unfortunately, bit the bait. He couldn't help it. The gates of the pits of Gehenna were open before him, and he decided to take a full right in. We give him a 10 out of 10, right? What does he say to the guy? Oh, I think that's just an allergic reaction. The guy had a fever, right? So nowadays, boy, rash, fever, I'm getting nervous, right? But back then, I didn't know. Okay, he had a fever. He took some antibiotic. So my brilliant friend tells him, oh, it must be a drug reaction. What did it turn out to be? Petechiae. Everybody know what that is? He was about to go into full sepsis, this guy. It was unbelievable. And he was just told by my friend, don't worry about it, just an Benadryl. Go home and take some Benadryl, which is what the guy did. We heard about all this a day later when he was like rushed emergently, you know, practically in septic shock to the emergency room because, you know, he had trusted these brilliant doctors who didn't lack the humility to just say, for God's sake, you're a first-year medical student. Have humility to that, and Allah has come to come throughout your entire career. So that's just like one small example. It's just my first exposure since then. I don't know if this is what triggered Alex's experience that got him into this topic, but I related to it because I've seen it so many times. But that's not really the final dimension. The final dimension, and the thing that I think will answer up, Abba Umna, is something that first came to my mind as I was reading this very interesting article on page 4. This is an article from a person who's pretty well known. His name is Jack Coulihan. He is a brilliant doctor, but he's more famous for his work in English literature and humanities. He's a very excellent writer. So he writes over here about humility, and he's a major bioethicist. So he gives us, what is medical humility? Humility is the medical virtue that he says is most difficult to understand in practice, but he ends up giving us an operational definition. What is it? Medical humility includes 4 distinct but closely related personal characteristics that are essential to good doctoring. Unpretentious openness, honest self-disclosure, avoidance of arrogance. Those 3 are basically what we've been talking about, right? All those things are recognition that you don't know everything, you've got to be willing to admit when you don't know it, and you got to be willing to refer out. If there's a rofe that's gadol minecha, you got to give it over. Then he throws in this 4th thing that really caught my eye, modulation of self-interest. What is that? What's modulation of self-interest? What does that have to do with humility? So it struck me, it's a good need, though, to modulate your self-interest. But why is it under humility? So then, there is, in C.S. Lewis, I think, pshat in that statement. He says the following. Do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, swarmy person. Uriah Heep? Who's he referring to here? I think he's referring to someone in Charles Dickens' book, but whatever. He's not going to be this slimy person who is always telling you that, of course, he's a nobody. Probably all you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about his humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. What's C.S. Lewis getting at? What he's getting at is the really highest madriga of humility. And it's the madriga of humility that is what I think allows doctors to stand out as being very, very special, an opportunity to be extremely special if you meet the challenge of reaching this level of humility. It's humility that's defined not in a qualitative sense. Until now, we've been talking about humility in a qualitative sense, which means you should think less of yourself, you should know the limits of yourself in a qualitative sense. This is talking about in a quantitative sense. You should think less often of yourself. You should be thinking of others. The emphasis is humility in the sense that you care very much and sincerely about other people. That is the humility of medicine. And this is something that on page 5 I wanted to demonstrate that the Rambam was very well aware of himself. It's an emphasis not on thinking that you're not very talented. It's an emphasis of not on thinking and being aware in a realistic, honest way that you have abilities that are special and you could be proud of them. You don't have to squelch your accomplishments. You don't have to think low of yourself like all those original definitions were suggesting. You could think very, very confidently. And you should. It's very important. You're going to be more effective as a doctor if you do. But what it's telling you is that despite that, it's like the pshat that we saw earlier, despite the fact that you're a gadol and a chacham and an ashir and all the great things in the world, you're still an anav in the following way. Like the melech and the kohen gadol. The Rambam says, b'derech shechilek lo hakasav hakavot hagadol, it's talking about a melech, the same way that the Torah and halacha gives the melech such an important status, that everything is geared up towards him being the kavod, and we, you know, like he, no one can marry his wife if he passed away. You know, every element of halacha that relates to the melech, he's such an important person, and he's put up on such a pedestal. So what does the Rambam say though? He says, "Kederech hazeh lo yinaheg gasos le b'Yisrael yesem b'day." He himself has to have a contrasting emotional internal self. While he's having all this grandeur about him, and he's so much up there, he's so significant and special, but the goal is for him to be the most humble when it comes to concern for other people. And the Rambam details, over here, I can't read through the whole thing because we're running out of time, but he details how that is the greatest expression of humility. For the king, who is being held up above everyone else in so many ways, but the midah that he's supposed to be sort of honing in himself is to be constantly concerned with the welfare of everyone who's beneath him. And that should be his focus. He should be humble, not in terms of ever being, he's not allowed to be mochel on his kavod. A king can't be mochel on his kavod. A king has to comport himself with tremendous self-assurance and confidence. He can never show in any way meekness and all those words that were in those original definitions. He needs to express an outward, tremendous, not arrogance, but very, very positive self-image. Yet, internally, he's supposed to be an anav in the fullest sense, in terms of not thinking about himself at all. Don't get caught up in it. Don't get caught up in how great you are. Let yourself be aware of it for when you need it, but you should be thinking all the time about helping other people. And Jonathan Sachs plays this up very much. This is very much his kind of idea. The model is Moshe, described in the Torah as very humble, more so than any person on the face of the earth. Humble here does not mean diffident, meek, self-abasing, timid, bashful, demure, or lacking self-confidence. Moshe was none of these. What it means is honoring others and regarding them as important, no less important than you are. It does not mean holding yourself low, it means holding others high. It's such a Rabbi Sacks kind of line, right? It means roughly what Ben Zoma meant in Pirkei Avos, who is honored, the person who is Mechabed is Abrios. And the reason this is so important, particularly in medicine, is it's the greatest challenge, I think, for a doctor, the greatest opening to the pits of Gehenna for potential doctors, is something that gets inculcated into everybody, starting in medical school, and then worse and worse as you go through residency and whatever you're going to do in terms of practicing. What am I referring to? There's a mindset that sets in for everybody to worry constantly about legal implications of what you're doing, right? One, and also the fact that you're being constantly supervised and assessed. So you're always worried about the impression you're making. You're worried about the legal impression you're making, and you're worried about the general impression you're making. When you get caught up in impressions, and this type of issue is what's motivating your actions towards patients, it is the biggest danger in the world and leads to tremendous, tremendous problems and tremendous disservice to patients. It is not a humility-based medicine. It's one that's running on, I've covered myself. And I can give you 1,000 examples of this. I'll just give you one. Very typical examples like this. There's a famous machlokas between Rav Shlomo Zalman, Rav Shechter on one hand, and the Tzitz Eliezer and the Binyan Tzion on another, on the issue of Ein Hochin Achar Rov when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, right? When it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, Safik, you're still going to be Docha, the Surin for Pikuach Nefesh. What happens if I have a situation where I'm not sure, there's no Cholo Lefaneinu, but I'm anticipating this might become Sakonas Nefashos? So the Tzitz Eliezer is very famous for saying, Hochin Achar Rov, when you have a situation like that, right? If you, you're on call, and your phone rings. Should you pick up? So you're saying, well, maybe someone's trying to page me. They're not able to get. I should pick up the phone. So it's only a rove possibility that's true, then pick up. Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Shechter say, don't define it that way. Define it differently. Define it by, what would you feel if you were a Tuesday? Would you feel this is a Sakonas Nefashos situation? Whatever you feel on Tuesday, that's what you'd feel on Shabbos. And then you use that to be Docha Shabbos. It's a very effective method. The only problem is, what if you define sakana in an adulterated fashion? What do I mean by that? A common scenario, let's say, I'll use one in my field, is you're the attending, and the fellow house staff are in the hospital. And there's a patient who comes in after surgery with possible something called post-pericardiotomy syndrome, which means their heart lining is inflamed, and there's going to be fluid around their heart. Now, a little fluid, no big deal. You say start them on some, you know, anti-inflammatory medication, they're good to go. A lot of fluid, or the right amount of fluid, is a life-threatening situation. So what is the attending at home supposed to do, right? Well, the house staff has the primary responsibility. They make the call. They should know how to do echo, right? They do the echo, and they tell you it's a small effusion, a moderate one, or a severe one. And then you decide. You don't go in, because you're the one who has to go in, you have the ultimate responsibility, unless it's one that's significant. So let's say it's June. So what's special about June in medicine? Finally, people know what they're doing, right? So comes June, and the guy calls up, the fellow, first year fellow even, says, hey, don't worry, it's a small effusion. So you can, in good conscience, stay home and take care of it. What about in July? Malpractice, right? If you stay home, everybody would have to agree that's malpractice. What do you do in January? And here it is, January. You have a decision to make. So I'll tell you right now, you're covered legally, impression-wise, if you don't go in. But is that really the right thing to do? Is that really being thoughtful of the life of that patient? Or is that really being, if you make a decision based on I'm covered legally, and I'm covered in terms of the impression I'm making, no matter what happens to that poor patient, that is Gehenna. That is a ticket behind. Do you see how subtle it is? I'm purposely giving you an example where it's like that type of decision. That type of decision is constant and continuous in medicine. I'm telling you right now, you will be faced all the time with these types of decisions where you're going to have to make a call. Am I really doing what's in the patient's best interest? So how does a person develop this quality to become like Abba Umna, who, by the way, all the examples he was doing was all selfless examples of caring about another person. That is what he was displaying. He was displaying the fact that doctors are constantly in a position where they have a challenge to either be consciously worried about another person and optimizing their care of the other person, or being concerned with self-centered interests like legal issues and being covered and not and being lazy and not going in. So the time's about up. So I'm going to run now through three pages very, very quickly, all outside. But the very interesting makaros that I recommend reading in there. You know, human nature, according to Western philosophers, many of them, and Richard Dawkins, is quite selfish, right? We're all very selfish by nature. That's what they say. Is it true? Of course, right? Rav Dessler says the same thing, right? I have the piece from Rav Dessler in Michtam Eliyahu where he says basically the same thing that they're all saying. The basic human nature is self-preservatory. It's totally focused on self. And that's the way it is. But Rav Dessler takes it to a different angle, obviously, than Richard Dawkins, right? Richard Dawkins sees it as justification for his philosophy. What Rav Dessler does is he says, no, you know, he asks the question, why did God do it this way? Why did God make us this way? Why are we so self-preserving? Why are we so self-focused and worried about ourselves so much? So, an amazing idea. He says, when you couple that with the yesod, that is, kol haTorah kulo, ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, it all makes a lot of sense. What is the Torah telling you when it says, ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha? It is a means of progressively developing within a person selflessness, humility in the sense of squelching the over concern about yourself and now floating it over to the other. The ahavta recha kamocha is not a really reachable goal, right? The Ramban can't really get there completely that you really think about other people like yourself. But if you start to realize that the things that matter to you, this is what the Torah's message is, and Chazal develop it very progressively, and Modesta outlines the whole thing, you can see it inside. It's a walking through progressively greater and greater levels of thinking about the other person. Up to the point that you train your emotions, right? The Rambam says you're expected to actually cultivate within yourself sincere emotions where the ahavta is a real emotion. You love the other person so much and care about them so much that it's going to be natural for you in all these situations we're talking about to gravitate towards doing not the legally advisable thing, but doing always what's in the best interest of the other person. Because you say to yourself, and this is the recommendation, if you want to know how to treat every single patient, you say to yourself, what would I do if this were me or my family? I always do that. I'm telling you, I sincerely do that. When I'm like in the middle of the night, I had this call, amazing situation, typical situation. I get a call in the middle of the night. There's a baby whose heart rate is like 180. They think it's SVT. Come on. SVT in a baby? 250 usually, right? Could it be? I don't know. I'm thinking, what should I do? You know, I'm fighting my Yetzer, and I'm saying, well, if that were my child, right, even Gaber Sali, I would be running in, right? I'd be running in for sure. How could I not do it now? So I go running in there. It turns out to be two Palestinians, right? That's okay. Still the right thing to do. I come in. And it was the baby, and the baby was actually in a very weird type of idioventricular rhythm, whatever, don't worry about the details. But the bottom line was, we got him out of it, he was saved, and it was the right thing. And I made that cheshbon, and I got rewarded in that particular case. You don't always get such a good reward. They named the baby after me, right? They heard I lived in Israel, Palestina, right? So that's my claim to fame. There's a kid named Palestina because of me. But that's not the important part of the story. What's important is the way my mind worked, I was very proud of myself. And that's the way you have to operate. You know, even if future terrorists might be around because of you. I want to just quote this, if I didn't get, because I'm rushing through at the end, but this is such an important point as to what humility in medicine really is. In summary, it's The first level is what I called and was chaperoning Alex a little about, the obvious level, which is it's obvious that everybody has to not let their ego and pride stop them from properly caring for patients and not overestimate their abilities and go to all the ends to investigate things. And when somebody asks you for a referral, don't just be yotze. This is another, this is another Gehenna move. I see this all the time, all the time. Hey, who do you think? They think you know, right? So they ask you, so who's a good orthopedist? Who's a good GI person? Who's a good this and that? Most of the time, you're not going to know. Just say the truth. Don't give them a name just to give a name and be yotze, because you're not doing anyone a favor. You're hurting people when you do that. So for sure, that's a madriga of humility that's essential. But what I was trying to introduce, and I see that is something that is very, very much even a more subtle and potent issue that exists for everyone going into medicine, is this other idea that I'll just quote to summarize it from, again, Rabbi Sacks. He says the following. Humility, then, is more than just a virtue. It's a form of perception, a language in which the I is silent so that I can hear the thou. The unspoken call beneath human speech, the divine whisper within all that moves, the voice of otherness that calls me to redeem its loneliness, this is very Rabbi Sacks, with the touch of love. Humility is what opens us to the world. What he's saying, again, is in effect the same yisod, that real humility, the ultimate madriga of humility, when you really made it, is the hafderecha kamocha, is to reach the madriga where your motivation in taking care of all your patients is one where you're honestly and sincerely motivated to do for them what you would really want for yourself and to care about them to that degree so that you don't fall into the pitfalls of Gehenna that are so commonly available. The last page of the article has a very interesting story of William Osler. So William Osler, a very famous doctor, who used to take this, right, Chochma Bagoyim and even Midos Tovas Bagoyim, he had an amazing habit. He used to, before he would do any procedure, he would do it on himself. So, for example, in his day, they didn't have a lot of the things we have today, but they had, let's say, a G-tube, which means putting down a tube down to somebody's stomach. So before he would do it to a patient, he would do it to himself. And they asked him, you know, they'd find him gagging, you know, trying to get this thing down his throat. What is, you need to call the psych ward or something, what's the matter with you? And he would say no. He says, it's not important just knowing the right thing for your patient and intellectualizing it. You have to feel and understand what they're experiencing. Because if you really want to be motivated towards caring for them in the proper, manner, then you have to really, to the best of your ability, empathize and experience exactly what they're doing. We should all be zocha to hit this incredibly high madrega, and be zocha to the hashrash hashchina yom yom, like Abba Umna. Thank you very much.
Thank you.